Beyond the headlines. This is World Insight.
Hello and welcome to World Insight with me, Tian Wei. UNHCR is the UN refugee agency. It is dedicated to saving lives and protecting refugee rights. In recent years, they are facing with a fragmented world and increasing number of conflicts worldwide. How do they try to do their work now? And how is it adjusting to the latest realities? How is it trying to attract attention and support from responsible stakeholders? My latest interview with Raouf Mazou, who is the UNHCR Assistant High Commissioner for Operations. How good to see you here in Beijing.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for the efforts that you've been making over the years for the refugee issue. Now we see increasing conflicts and displacements. As a result of that, many wonder, how would UNHCR prioritize? Because you see the fires all over the world.
Yes. No, you're right. The fact is that we've never seen so many or so much displacement as we are seeing now. More than 114 million people who are displaced, internally displaced, but also refugees. And you can't really prioritize, because when you have a crisis, the only thing that you do is you try to respond to the most recent crisis. The most recent crisis, global crisis that we're seeing now is the crisis in Sudan, which has resulted in movement into neighboring countries. But at the same time, you have the crisis in Ukraine. You also have refugee situations that have lasted for the past 20 years. So you have to find a way of responding to all crises.
What is that way for you?
The prioritization, I would say, you try to respond to the needs of the most needy, of the most vulnerable. But you also have to prioritize the most recent crisis. If you have a refugee situation that has lasted for quite some time, you expect that people are beginning to cope to a certain extent, but those who just cross border, just arrived, need immediate assistance. What we're seeing, indeed, is a reduction in the resources that we are in a position of mobilizing because of all this crisis. Humanitarian resources are more difficult to mobilize. But what we see more and more is that development actors, international financial institutions, World Bank, for instance, and others, are now understanding the importance of them being involved in responding to forced displacement. So that's additional resources that are coming in, which we, of course, have to use well.
What does it mean for the skill sets that you need to have? Because you are now more into communication with the other brother and sister organizations.
It means, as you say, it means partnership, understanding about partnerships in a different way. It means for some of our colleagues who have focused primarily on emergency response to also be able to look at long term. There are refugee situations which have lasted for the past 20, 30 years. How do you transition from a situation where people are dependent on humanitarian assistance to one where they are more self-reliant? So the kind of skills that it requires is development expertise, which of course is different from the emergency. So there too we need to update and change a bit some of our skills. And what we actually try to do now is also to bring some of our long-term development actors to the emergency response from day one. I give one example. Our High Commissioner Filippo Grandi was in Chad a few months ago with the Managing Director of the World Bank, Anna Birge, and that was in the middle of an emergency. So in the middle of an emergency, you had Filippo Grandi, High Commissioner for Refugees, dealing with emergencies, and at the same time, one of the Managing Directors of the World Bank, trying to see from the beginning of a crisis how they can start from day one being involved and envisaging also the long-term response.
You also need the resources ready when crises happen. So how is that being worked on a daily basis?
So we have systems that we've put in place for emergency response. We have stockpiles in a number of places. One of the biggest stockpiles that we have of core relief items is in Dubai. And from there, we can immediately, in 72 hours, deploy some of these goods. We also have colleagues who are trained on a regular basis and are on standby, ready to be deployed in 72 hours anywhere. And we also have resources that we put at the disposal of our colleagues, money, financial resources that we put at the disposal of our colleagues when an emergency. And I must say that one of the very positive conversations that I've had here in China, the day before yesterday we were in Shanghai, was to hear from some of the private sector companies dealing with solar energy and the rest. First, how much they are willing to be part of the response, and how in some cases they are part of the response, and we've seen that without necessarily being aware. A lot of the solar panels, and China is a leader in solar energy, a lot of the solar panels that are produced by China are deployed in various emergencies around the world. But what we heard from all of them, all those who we met, is eagerness and willingness to be part
forward.
Of the response, to step forward. With something which is, I would say, additional to what we've seen so far, is the issue of self-reliance. When you speak to them about how do we make sure that refugees are self-reliant, you immediately see an interest. Some of them make that reference of saying, if somebody is in a situation of crisis, help that person fish rather than just provide the fish. Mm-hmm. So it may sound just as an anecdote, but it's important that China provides to the world its expertise in making sure that you lift populations out of poverty and that you shift from being dependent to humanitarian assistance to being self-reliant. And I would say in that regard, China has an expertise that is unique, that is very much needed in the refugee context around the world.
Now, we see media reports about increasing casualties of humanitarian workers on the front line recently, especially involved in some of the key conflicts in the world. I really wonder, with a huge team of yours always on the front line, how are you dealing with this reality?
We keep on repeating that humanitarian workers should not be a target, that the role that humanitarians play around the world is a role that everybody requires, making sure that despite situations of conflict, humanitarian assistance, protection of the most vulnerable people continues to be provided. As you say, we are seeing a massive increase in the number of humanitarian workers who are victims. Gaza is an example where we've seen many of our UNRWA colleagues being killed. So we keep on reminding all parties of the conflict that it is their responsibility to make sure that humanitarian workers are protected. In any situation of crisis, war, humanitarian access continues to be provided in an unhindered manner. That this is crucial, and that humanity is absolutely essential, regardless of the situation or circumstances in which people find themselves.
Two major challenges, as we see in terms of crisis, one in Gaza, the other Russia-Ukraine crisis. Now, your colleagues, I know, are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, but how do you see the nature of these conflicts, and what are some of the things you have learned over the past 2 years about them?
No, it's true. I would say what is characteristic is the fact that it's more and more difficult to categorize conflicts. You have all type of conflicts. Mm-hmm. The conflict that you currently have in Ukraine is very different from what you're seeing in Gaza. Yeah. It's very different from what you're seeing in Sudan. It's very different from what you're seeing right now in the eastern part of DRC. Mm-hmm. What you, unfortunately, and what is common in all these conflicts is disregard for humanitarian principles and disregard for the lives of humanitarian workers, and the difficulty that you see in seeing a resolution to some of these conflicts. The other concern is, of course, the fact that the mechanisms that exist to manage conflicts and help bring an end to conflict do not seem to be working in a very, very polarized world. The issue of ability for multilateralism to continue to function as a system is actually today a question. So you see this multiplication of conflicts. You don't really see the end to these conflicts, and you don't really see efforts to kind of manage these conflicts as they are taking place. So I think that's the concern, but it brings us back to the role of the United Nations. It brings us back to the role of regional organizations also, and the role of the large powers, whether they are on the Security Council, permanent manner or not. But there is responsibility, right, on the part of of member states to find solutions to all these conflicts.
You know, even for journalism, for example, I've been in this trade for about 25 years, and I saw the value system that were very much aligned around the world at the very beginning of my journalism days, till today, a very fragmented world. And the value system about what is good, what is bad, who is good for what, has been ever shifting. And we don't see a system that everybody subscribes to anymore. And therefore, this gives people with the right minded a tremendous amount of difficulties to do their job. We were at a time when technologies were pretty much providing support to overall humanity, because there were internet was very much used after the Cold War ended, and they speed up the wealth. But now we are in a very different stage, that technologies are developing so fast, such as AI, at a time when rules are so fragmented.
I think it's paradoxical, because we are in a situation where you've never had so much wealth in the world. You've never had so much technology which allows the creation of goods at a very reasonable price. Healthcare can be provided through using technology and through AI at a better price than ever before, at a lower cost than ever before. Education, it's the same. And then you end up having all these goods which are actually being sold even at a higher price than it should be. So it is the inequality, it is the discrepancy that this creates, which is creating even more conflict, which is creating even more frustration among populations around the world. Frustration lead to conflict and lead to situations where you have now the highest number of people displaced. So at the end of the day, it all brings back to how resources are being distributed, managed in an environment where there is abundance of resources. And if these resources are managed and distributed in a proper way, we will definitely see a reduction in conflict and a reduction in the number of people who are displaced.
You started in Africa, your first assignment related to UNHCR, some of the most controversial and protracted conflict.
Yeah.
And from there, it continues to be in different parts of the world. And now, working very much on the most important missions of UNHCR, what moment do you remember was the time for you to really understand, you know, the tremendous difficulties that you're likely to face, and give you the power to see, no matter what, I'm here for the job that I believe in?
I think for me it was fairly early, and when I joined UNHCR, and I joined UNHCR in the northern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was then Zaire, I was dealing with refugees from Sudan, which now is South Sudan, people who had crossed into DRC. And what was remarkable is that they had not been receiving food assistance for a very long period of time, and yet they were fending for themselves. Mm-hmm. So you had a situation of people who had arrived in a place, had been displaced, were refugees, but their resilience was such, and the support that they were getting from the host community was such, mm-hmm. that they were fending for themselves. What they needed from us was simply to provide them with some support to make sure that they would continue to fend for themselves. So what I derived from that experience from the beginning, and everywhere I've been, and what I've heard from refugees everywhere I've been, is give us the means to fend for ourselves. We have found ourselves in a situation of displacement, but we still have the skills, knowledge that we had when we were in our country. Just make sure that we can continue. And the protection that they require from us is this, to make sure that they are not discriminated against because they found themselves in a situation of displacement. Of course, at the beginning, when they're displaced, they may need some humanitarian assistance, but very quickly, what I've heard from them, and that I heard from the very first time that I spent in the organization, is give people the means to fend for themselves, mm-hmm. and that's the best protection that you can give to people who find themselves in displacement.
We know that this is a much more fragmented world, and the role of the UN, also the roles of different UN organizations, including yours, has been challenged as a result. So how do you see this change? What is like to be caught in between among so many different things, politics, geopolitics, economics, technologies, all of these are moving factors for you. What was it like?
The fact is that when there is a conflict and there is displacement, our role of providing humanitarian assistance is clear. What is sometimes more unclear is the fact that we are not providing a solution, and humanitarian assistance is not a solution to the problem. It's simply a way of dealing with
the crisis.
But those who need to deal with the problem, with the cause of humanitarian situation or humanitarian crisis, still need to take the action. And it's not, humanitarian responses are not there to address political causes. It's all linked, but it is important, and you've made reference to that earlier. It's key that in a situation of conflict, humanitarian principles remain, and that those who need assistance, who need emergency assistance, humanitarian assistance, continue to be provided with support in situations of conflict.
Raoul, what a pleasure to see you, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, the UN Development Program Administrator sounds the alarm over the widening divide of the Human Development Index. The details next.
Beyond the headlines. This is World Insight.
Welcome back. This is World Insight. I'm Tian Wei. Uneven growth is leaving the poorest behind, worsening inequality and stoking political polarization. That's according to the 2023 Human Development Report released by the United Nations Development Program, or UNDP. This resulted in a dangerous gridlock that needs collective action. The report is an important part of UNDP's work. On this and more, I talked to Akim Steiner, the administrator of UNDP. It is a very exciting find out of the latest Human Development Report. Tell me how you and your colleagues have been preparing for this, and what do you think people should take away as the key message?
After the pandemic, for the first time now in 2023, we saw globally the Human Development Index recover. And that is good news. It shows that people, economies, societies, markets are recovering. But two very red flashing lights also in this year's Human Development Report, one pointing to an uneven and partial recovery, because particularly for poorer countries, least developed countries, low-income countries, that recovery is not happening. They are trapped in a post-pandemic, both financial and economic crisis, but also the inability to invest in the future. And that is an element of this year's report, also a very close look at the increasing polarization we are seeing. Within countries, because of inequality, insecurity, we see a growing fracture in the political discourse, in many societies, radicalization, but also, and this is also concerning at the global and international level, because the report repeatedly points to the fact that the world is bound to cooperate to address the great challenges of our time, and yet we seem to be seeing more and more tensions, geopolitical, but also more and more conflicts and crises, and this is affecting human development across the globe.
But what could be the solution to fix it?
The ability to cooperate internationally is a precondition for success, whether it is climate change, preparing for the next pandemic, whether it is the digital revolution and artificial intelligence. All of these are developments that require countries to work together. And this is why in the United Nations, but also in the Human Development Report, we are pointing towards a number of areas where we need to recognize that there are global public goods. And whether they are the climate-related ones, whether they are the digital public goods, or whether they're also the ability to bring more financing and investment, particularly to poorer developing economies. This is a crucial variable, because what we also observe and highlight is that post-pandemic, many countries have exhausted their fiscal space. They are deeply indebted, and many countries are now paying more in interest to service their debt than they're able to invest in their education or health sector, never mind in a cleaner energy infrastructure or a digital public infrastructure.
You see some of the emerging economies, developing countries, China included, trying to work on that. But now, with a fragmented world, many issues very hard to push forward. There were also setbacks. So from your perspective, how is the backdrop of geopolitics providing all these complexities? Do you think, as an organization of yours, aiming at development could be doing something at least to begin with.
Two things are particularly concerning. First of all, we have more conflicts in the world in 2023 than at any point since the Second World War.
Yeah.
And that also explains we have, you know, well over 100 million refugees, internally displaced peoples. Economies are essentially being driven backwards. Take a country like Yemen, take a country like Ukraine, like Afghanistan. The loss in human development there is sometimes measured literally in decades lost. And this is one area in which clearly it is very difficult for the UN to simply step into a conflict. It requires a great deal of international cooperation. We are seeing that eroded because of the geopolitical tensions, whether it's in the Security Council, whether it is in the General Assembly. In that sense, the UN is a mirror image of where the world finds itself right now, disrupted with a lot of tensions. At the same time, what we also see is that domestic policies and how governments responded to the pandemic, how they're investing in addressing inequality, how they're addressing, for example, decarbonization, the investment in digital access, affordable access, can also fundamentally change the trajectory of a country's development path. And this is why the report is not only describing the challenges and crises, it is actually focused on the opportunities that are there. But it is a world that at the moment is not seizing them. On the contrary, it seems to be drifting apart, and we are losing our ability to actually tackle these issues.
You have seen what we are facing today, one challenge after another. Where you are sitting would know more even than I do about that. Do you feel frustrated? How early was the frustration? And now how do you digest these frustrations and turn them into energies to focus on actions that can change at least a bit by bit?
Well, let's start with a very simple human phenomenon. There is a lot of misperception and a lot of misinformation in the world today. The Human Development Report has a very interesting illustration when people were interviewed across the world and asked, how much would you be willing to invest yourself of your own money in addressing climate change? 70% of the respondents said, I would be willing to do that. When you ask the same group of people, what do you think others would be willing to do? They said, well, maybe 40% would be doing or willing to do something. And here you have a classic example where people will not act because they think others will not act. We have to address a lot of misperception, misinformation. We have to also get people's confidence and also understanding that in this day and age, for example, with climate change, nations are bound to work together. We cannot succeed alone. And that is why, for example, the investments in decarbonization, renewable energy are so vital. And this is particularly where wealthier countries must also step in to assist poorer countries to make that transition. We have a global energy economy. We have a global food economy. We are bound to, in a sense, drive that global economy together, or it will create a lot of disruptions. And this is partly where I think there is a lot of reasons to be frustrated, but let us also acknowledge on the renewable energy front, we just saw in 2023 a record year of investment, China playing a very critical and central role here. $1.8 billion invested in new clean energy infrastructure, but only 2-3% of that investment actually landed on the continent of Africa, where the need for energy and access to electricity is perhaps the greatest in the world today.
One thing is we have seen some interesting development, some positive ones. For example, the UN resolution on AI governance and also the latest UN resolution on Gaza ceasefire. But many wonder whether this is just the cream on top, whether these resolutions will easily evaporate away.
The first thing we have to tackle, however, is a concentration in particularly in corporate terms of access and control of technology and markets. For instance, few people realize that the three top tech companies in the world individually each were larger than 90% of the countries with their GDP. So you can see an extraordinary concentration. Secondly, we have very few guardrails on the deployment of a technology that could fundamentally affect people, societies, public information, and also leave behind billions of people if we don't drive this development in a way that is inclusive. So I think the fact that countries have come together in the United Nations at this moment to put forward a resolution on artificial intelligence is a good sign. And frankly, we have seen a number of very positive developments, for instance, also in the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Framework, when China presided over the Convention on Biological Diversity last year, a groundbreaking agreement was reached. The world can collaborate, but it must look for ways in which to overcome the tensions and differences And I think particularly when it comes to new technologies, we have to make sure that we are together as a world community, as a community of nations, because otherwise these technologies could lead to extraordinary inequalities, leaving billions of people behind, and that is no viable way forward.
And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of the team, thanks for being with us. Bye for now.